Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The war in Afghanistan is far from over. Last week, the U.S. took two steps back with top commander General Stanley McChrystal's ouster, and new reports indicate Pakistan is stepping in to fill the void. What does Pakistan's new role in Afghanistan mean for the U.S.? We'll ask our panel of distinguished experts. This hour on Point, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the role of the U.S. You can join the conversation. With Pakistan stepping in, are you worried about where this leaves the U.S.? Can we still pull this off? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first this hour from Washington, D.C. is Scott Shane. He's national security reporter for The New York Times in the Washington Bureau. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Jane.
How is the U.S. responding to Pakistan's increased engagement with Afghanistan and the Taliban?
Well, the big pushback came from Leon Panetta, the CIA director, on Sunday. He essentially said that he saw no prospect that any element of the insurgency, the Taliban coalition, was prepared for serious negotiations towards some kind of power-sharing arrangement, which is the premise on which Pakistan is operating. Basically, the American position has been that the Taliban are unlikely to seriously negotiate until they are in a worse military position, until their momentum is broken, and they are, you know, feeling greater heat from the NATO military effort. But there was a slightly different message on Sunday from President Obama.
Well, that's right. They had a very different response, didn't they not?
Yeah. I mean, President Obama also said that Americans should be skeptical about these efforts organized by Pakistan to forge some kind of deal in Afghanistan. But he also sort of projected greater openness than the CIA director did. He is a president with a very ambitious domestic program. He inherited two wars. He's obviously eager to get them settled. And a lot of Americans, of course, are eager to see the troops come back. So he did say that ultimately there's going to have to be a political solution in Afghanistan, which suggests that you have to talk to some elements of the Taliban. And President Obama made the point that the Taliban are a very much a mixed bag, ranging from people who are very close to al-Qaeda to basically kids for whom this was the best job available.
So how does the July 2011 date for U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan factor into this new sort of relationship, this cozier relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, Pakistan has seen the U.S. come into the region in a big way during the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And then pack its bags and leave. And so the projected beginning of a withdrawal of some American troops in July 2011 for Pakistan, to some degree for Afghanistan, is a bit of a red flag. Pakistan Pakistani leaders think, well, you know, they want some input into what's going to happen on their border. And so they, you know, got much more aggressive about working towards some kind of settlement as opposed to just waiting for U.S. troops to leave and having a vacuum filled by chaos and civil war as happened in, after the Soviet pullout.
So with this new relationship seemingly forming here, is there an impending shift in U.S. strategy, especially with General David Petraeus now taking over in Afghanistan?
Well, certainly the official line is that there is no change of strategy, and I think that is indeed what the administration believes, that they need to continue with this counterinsurgency strategy, try and win over the population of Afghanistan, try to deal some defeats to the Taliban, and they have been quietly bumping off a lot of Taliban leaders in recent months. But, you know, that it's clear to everybody that this is not going to be a completely military solution, and that ultimately, at some point, there are going to have to be negotiations. And so that's not exactly a new policy, but certainly the president projected that that's part of the future policy.
Well, Scott Shane, joining me from Washington, D.C., thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Scott is New York Times national security reporter from Washington, based in Washington. Let me bring in another expert on this subject here. From Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I'm joined by Larry Goodson. He's professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College and is regularly consulted by senior government officials about Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Middle East. He's author of Afghanistan's Endless War, State Failure, Regional Politics, and the Rise of the Taliban, and of the forthcoming book, Pakistan, Five Things Everyone Should Know. Larry Goodson, nice to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Hi.
So how do you view Pakistan's increased involvement in negotiations with Afghanistan and the Taliban?
Well, Pakistan has long been involved in Afghanistan and, to be sure, is very interested in seeing a government in Afghanistan that sort of meets its national security concerns. It's very concerned about India's involvement in Afghanistan. India, China, Russia, the United States, NATO, Iran, everybody is involved in Afghanistan. And now you have, you know, this announcement of large mineral resources in Afghanistan, so that you're probably going to see even more of that. And so Pakistan has a lot of interest there and is trying, as you just heard, to sort of prepare for the moment when the American and Western presence in Afghanistan begins to diminish, which comes, you know, sometime after July 2011, as you just said.
I'm reading a lot of U.S. officials who are expressing skepticism about this and wondering if Pakistan is really to be trusted in this negotiation process. They have been involved for many years, as you say, but it seems something is a bit different this time. Do you agree?
They've been involved in a lot of ways. I mean, I always tell people Pakistan has its own strategic triad, just like we have, you know, during the Cold War years, our nuclear triad. They have a strategic triad. Their military, their large conventional military, their nuclear arsenal, which has become quite prominent in recent years, and for many years the support of militants who could engage in activities in Afghanistan or in the Kashmir or elsewhere where their obviously their nuclear arsenal or their army couldn't go. So because of that, they have deep ties to a lot of these militant actors, and to be sure they could have influence over the Haqqani network or the Quetta Shura Taliban. And yet at the same time, they have a big militant problem in their country. There are some splits between the Afghan and the Pakistani Taliban. So there is something changed, which is the changed dynamic of the threat of militants to Pakistan's state and to the metropolitan areas of Pakistan. Yet at the same time, a lot of what you're seeing in terms of their efforts to pull strings and to play a role are sort of straight out of the old playbook.
You talk about the deep ties to militant networks within Pakistan, and you mentioned the Haqqani network. Help us understand who they are and what their relationship is to the Pakistani government.
Well, the senior Haqqani, Jalaluddin, was one of the big commanders during the anti-Soviet jihad of the 1980s, which the U.S. and the Pakistanis and the Saudis and the Chinese and everybody sort of joined together, you know, Charlie Wilson's war and all that, to defeat the Soviets. Jalaluddin operated out of North Waziristan. He was one of the senior commanders, a religious scholar. His son, Sirajuddin, is now the sort of head of this organization, or the functional head from day to day. And Jalaluddin had ties in the Pakistani intelligence service, the Inner Services Intelligence Directorate, and with the CIA. He was a very important commander. And then in the 1990s, shifted his allegiance when the Taliban took over most of Afghanistan, became one of the supporters of the Taliban. And so they still operate out of that area. North Waziristan's the one tribal agency that the Pakistani army has not really been able to conduct, you know, the full-scale operations in. And some people believe that they still have kind of a role in maintaining the Haqqani network.
Indeed. I'm reading here from the New York Times. Haqqani fighters have been used by Pakistan to hit Indian targets inside Afghanistan and even American targets as well. So it's a complicated relationship, is it not?
Well, it is, and it goes to the complexity, as I said before, of this sort of strategic triad. If your army can't do what it's supposed to do or to the level that you would like, and you can't use your nuclear weapons, but you still have foreign policy interests that require a certain amount of violence, maybe these militants can do the job, and so you don't want to get rid of them altogether. So, but the sort of the calibration of who do you support and who do you pull away from is a very complex mess, especially when these militants, I mean, the militancy that was once sort of isolated out in this remote tribal area has become now quite threatening to the Pakistani state itself.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Pakistan and Afghanistan and what their relationship means for the United States. I'm joined this hour by Larry Goodson. He's professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College and is regularly consulted by senior government officials about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East. I'd like now also to bring in from Lahore, Pakistan, Middle East expert Ahmad Rashid. He frequently writes for the International Herald Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, the Daily Telegraph, and many other publications. His books include Taliban, The Power of Militant Islam in Afghanistan and Beyond, and Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Ahmad Rashid, it's such a pleasure to have you back at On Point. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And also joining me from Washington, D.C. is James Dobbins. He's director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. He's held senior White House and State Department positions under four presidents, most recently serving as the Bush administration's special envoy for Afghanistan. He's author of After the Taliban, Nation Building in Afghanistan. James Dobbins, nice to have you with us, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ahmad Rashid, let me turn to you first there in Lahore. Why is Pakistan's influence in the region, why does it seem to be growing?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, I think Pakistan is very concerned about the American departure from this region. It considers that the U.S. and NATO will be leaving very, very soon once this date, July 2011, is reached. They'll be pulling out. They're fearful of that. Secondly, they're fearful of the Indian presence in Afghanistan. They believe, the Pakistani military believe, that India has got Pakistan surrounded, as it were, and that it is using its embassies and consulates in Kabul to undermine Pakistan, and it wants to reestablish its own influence in Afghanistan, which, of course, it had enormous influence in the 1990s when the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and Pakistan was one of only three countries that were actually recognized the Taliban and supported the Taliban. So And thirdly, I think they also feel that they'd like to get rid of these Taliban, Afghan Taliban extremist groups who have been living on their soil for the last 9 years, and try and broker a peace agreement with Karzai and send them back into Afghanistan so that they can deal with their own Taliban threat, which is rising all the time.
Mm. James Dobbins, is this new relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan, is it about building trust between these two nations, or does the U.S. see itself sort of quietly being pushed out of the picture with these negotiations and this relationship building?
I don't think the United States sees itself in competition with Pakistan in this regard. I think U.S. officials welcome Pakistani efforts to try to broker some kind of agreement. But I think Pakistan's role can't be isolated from the broader international context. Pakistan has clients, has influence with sectors of Afghan society, but so do India, Iran, Russia, the United States. If you're going to achieve an enduring peace in Afghanistan, you're going to have to bring all sectors of Afghan society into the process, and that means bringing all of the neighboring states and near neighboring states that have influence into the process. So I don't think Pakistan's role can be seen in isolation. I think the United States needs to work quietly, not just with Pakistan, but with the other states who've traditionally played a role in Afghanistan in an effort to try to bring convergent pressures on the Afghans towards some kind of reconciliation, which I incidentally don't think is going to come anytime soon, but will probably come eventually.
And so, Ahmed Rashid, will reconciliation with some rank-and-file Taliban fighters be necessary for any peace deal then in this region?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, the international community is faced with a crisis. It's not that just there's a lot of questioning of this war in America. In Europe, the situation is even worse. Every government in Europe that has troops in Afghanistan is facing public pressure for those troops to be pulled out. So I think, you know, we are going to see quite a dramatic, frankly, withdrawal of a lot of countries pulling out their troops, money that is going to Afghanistan being reduced. I don't think everybody's going to pull out immediately, but certainly there's going to be a very sharp drop come next summer. And once that happens, of course, the Taliban will be highly emboldened. A lot of the neighboring countries will be trying to find their own solutions without the Americans. So I think it's very important that the Americans get involved with the political reconciliation process as quickly as possible, not delayed any further, so that the Americans can help position themselves and help make sure that these neighbors don't that this doesn't end like a cat fight between the neighbors over Afghanistan.
And so, Larry Goodson, what is the U.S. involvement currently in these recent talks between Pakistan and Afghanistan? Is the U.S. even at the table?
Well, the United States created as a part of the new Obama approach to this a position that we all know about that Ambassador Holbrooke occupies as a strategic representative representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we've initiated a strategic dialogue recently, or we and the Pakistanis together have engaged in strategic dialogue. We don't want to forget that Pakistan is a major non-NATO ally for the United States, special status, that 80% of our supplies for Afghanistan cross Pakistani territory. Pakistan has a lot at stake, as Ahmed and Jim were saying, in its own territory and regionally. So the United States has been playing a role, but we've had real questions about, as you asked earlier to Ahmed, sort of whether the reconciliation effort focuses on these senior folks like the Haqqanis, for example, or whether it focuses on these rank-and-file villagers who are basically seeking money or some way of putting bread on the table, so to speak, from day to day. We've been very interested in this reintegration of low-level fighters and less interested in reconciliation at the senior-most level. But I think there is a role, as Jim Dobbins said, for the United States through the good offices of Holbrooke to do that.
let's get a call in here from Dan in Boston. Hi, welcome to On Point, Dan.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question regards U.S. support for President Karzai. The man seems to be incredibly corrupt. His brother is the largest heroin and opium dealer in the country, albeit the world. And he has consistently gone against stated U.S. position, especially over the past few years, outright saying that he would rather join the Taliban at one point than support the U.S. position. Why is it that the U.S. government continues to support Karzai when he's almost becoming more of a liability than an asset?
Dan, thank you. Ahmed Rashid?
Well, the relationship with Karzai has been very complicated. Certainly, he started off very well. He was certainly Mr. Clean back in 2001. He didn't have blood on his hands. And he was generally acceptable to the majority of the population. And he was elected president in 2004 with a landslide and remained very popular. The problem, I think, has been that, you know, he's been surrounded by some warlords, crooks, his own brothers, people who've had enormous influence on him, and he's made some very wrong decisions. He's become, I think, very isolated in his palace. He doesn't get out very much. He doesn't meet many ordinary people. It's very easy to feed him rumors and conspiracies, and so there definitely has been a very steady deterioration in his performance, in his beliefs, in what he stands by. But it must also be said that he is probably deeply concerned about this July date of the start of an American withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously now trying to come to terms with the neighboring countries to try and strike out on his own, minus the Americans, put together a new regional alliance of the neighboring countries, which would make sure that his own survival would, that would ensure his own survival and ensure that, you know, he carries on as president because he doesn't feel he can trust the Americans for staying on there.
James
now,
Dobbins, James Dobbins, has Hamid Karzai soured on the Americans, do you think? And how does that play into these negotiations now?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to note that nobody has accused Karzai of personal corruption. What they have accused him of is tolerating corruption on the part of officials, including members of his family, most notably his half-brother, who is incidentally not an appointed official. He's an elected official, not appointed by Karzai. But of tolerating these levels of corruption, and the U.S. has put a lot of pressure on him to try to crack down. I think that Karzai, as Ahmed has suggested, has become concerned that the U.S. will withdraw precipitously, leaving him behind to suffer the consequences, and therefore is, for instance, reaching out to Pakistan to see whether that the Pakistanis can broker some kind of agreement with the insurgents. That's a somewhat oversimplified picture, but I think there is an element. Personally, I don't think the United States is going to abandon Afghanistan, and I think there will be a major debate in this country about the degree to which we should begin withdrawing next year, a debate which hasn't been resolved, and I think some people in the area, including particularly in Pakistan, are taking as a firm American decision what is still a very open issue.
Larry Goodson from the U.S. Army War College, I know you helped run Hamid Karzai's election in 2002. How do you feel about that election and him now?
Well, yeah, I was involved, and like Ahmed and Jim, I've known Karzai many years. But for me, if I can take that question in a slightly different direction and come back to Dan's core question, not to dodge it, but but to go to his question, I think this is the fundamental problem area in our strategy. And it is simply this: counterinsurgency on behalf of a government that much of the people of a country feel is illegitimate, regardless of you know, the excellent points that Jim made, for example, about Karzai personally not being accused of corruption and so forth, that the people find this government to be one that they don't find legitimate. It's very difficult for a counterinsurgency strategy then to succeed. I think that's why you've seen so much pressure from the U.S. recently on corruption, on trying to get Karzai to clean up the government. But unfortunately, that has been kind of muddied by this expected withdrawal that the other guest talked about. And so I agree with what Ahmed was saying. Back in 2001, 2002, when we were facilitating the process of a transition towards democratic style of governance and Karzai was elected, we all thought that he was, you know, Mr. Clean and a great guy, and very much true. But a lot of things have gone wrong since then.
Ahmed Rashid, I'm curious how you see Pakistan, and if you see Pakistan in any way exploiting the U.S. withdrawal of troops July 2011, at least the announcement or the plan for that, and the difficulty that the U.S. seems to be having militarily in Afghanistan. Is Pakistan exploiting any of that in any way to position itself to be a stronger power in the region?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Pakistan is, and especially the military, which is running foreign policy and which is certainly running Afghan policy. The military is obsessed with India. It's obsessed with India's presence in Afghanistan, and it wants to get rid of it. And it sees this as a golden opportunity. If it can broker a dialogue between the Taliban and Karzai and the Americans, one of the conditions and the major conditions that Pakistan will stipulate there will be that, a reduction of India's presence in Afghanistan. Now, I think that's probably very unrealistic. Either Afghanistan is a sovereign nation and can take its own decisions, or it isn't. The other factor, of course, is what has been brought up by some of the earlier speakers, is that if Pakistan tries to get 100% of what it wants, there's no way that India is going to tolerate that, nor is Iran going to tolerate that, nor are the Central Asian Republics or Russia. These are all powerful neighbors and countries who have a lot of influence in Afghanistan. And we will be... The big fear is that if Pakistan goes the whole hog in wanting everything its own way, we will be back to the 1990s, where, of course, all the neighboring countries fueled the civil war in Afghanistan, and it was the most ruinous time for Afghanistan.
In our last minute before I have to let you go, Ahmed, you mentioned India, Iran, Russia. How does Pakistan's growing role, what does it mean for U.S. strategy long-term and the long-term influence that we might have in that region?
Well, obviously, I think what the Pakistani military wants to do is to try and broker a dialogue between the United States government and the Taliban and Karzai, and it wants to be the broker for that. It wants to be one of the major beneficiaries of that. So it's not that Pakistan is trying to the U.S., actually. It's trying to say to the U.S., well, look, we're giving you a way out of here. If you want to leave, leave a politically settled Afghanistan with the Taliban perhaps having a share of power and settling with you, America, as well. Now, again, we're back to this question exactly, what pound of flesh is Pakistan going to be asking for and whether the neighboring countries are going to be acceptable to that.
And so, bottom line, do you think the U.S. Proposed withdrawal of troops July 2011, do you think that will hold?
I think it certainly will. And I think before July 2011, we're going to see even more pressure inside the United States by Congress and by the public and the media for a really serious withdrawal. President Obama so far has been fairly non-committal on exactly what extent the withdrawal will take place, and he said that it will be very staggered, and the trainers and other kinds of and troops and will remain in Afghanistan for several years. And certainly, we know that the Pentagon is doing planning for several years ahead. It's not planning just until 2011. Nevertheless, I think the mood in Europe and the mood in the United States over the next 12 months is going to be very much in favor of a much more drastically fast pullout. And this is what the region and Pakistan in particular, and of course the Afghans, are deeply, deeply worried about.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan, and U.S. foreign policy this hour, and you can join our conversation. We're speaking this hour with Larry Goodson, professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College. He is regularly consulted by senior government officials about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East. Also with us is James Dobbins, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. He's held senior White House and State Department positions under four U.S. presidents, most recently serving as the Bush administration's special envoy for Afghanistan. Here's a press conference after the G20 summit in Toronto on Sunday, where President Barack Obama spoke about the recent Afghani effort to negotiate with the Taliban.
As was true in Iraq, so will be true in Afghanistan. We're going to have a political solution, not simply a military solution. Now, with respect to the negotiations and efforts at reintegration, I think it's too early to tell.
Let me ask you about those negotiations and the efforts of reintegration, Larry and James. I'm looking at a piece from the Washington Post that suggests or says flat out that Pakistan's primary intelligence agency finances, trains, and at least partially controls the Afghan Taliban insurgency. The report was issued by the London School of Economics and is based on interviews with Taliban commanders and former Taliban officials. They conclude that the official Pakistani policy in Afghanistan to support the rebellion is an offense against Indian influence in the region, especially in Afghanistan. So obviously it's very complicated, but what does it mean when you're talking about so many interconnected parties here, Larry, coming to the table?
Well, it's just as Ahmed said a few minutes ago, the Pakistanis the Pakistani military quite concerned about growing Indian influence it perceives in Afghanistan, especially aware that the, you know, for example, the port that the Chinese built in Gwadar in western Pakistan has now been flanked by the Indian help to the Iranians to build the port in Chabahar and then build a road into western Afghanistan through Zaranj, the westernmost town in Afghanistan. So very concerned about that, and consequently Pakistan, aware that the clock is apparently ticking for the United States, it seems to me, trying to hedge its bets a little bit using, as I said before, an old page out of the playbook with regard to Afghanistan. I also just want to say one last thing in relation to that Ahmed brought up, which is that in the historical playing of the great game, as it used to be called in the 19th century in Afghanistan, between, in those days, Russia and Britain, you never tried to really win in Afghanistan because, as Ahmed said, you can't get 100% of your interest. The other powers won't allow it, but you have to avoid losing. So I think that's what you're seeing right now with regard to Pakistan. But it is complex because of the realities of what all of this has meant for Pakistan domestically.
James Dobbins, will India tolerate a new and stronger alliance between Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think you're going to see an alliance between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I think India will respond to any threats to its interests, and that's why negotiation that's brokered exclusively by Pakistan is likely to be unacceptable to others, including the United States, and therefore isn't going to happen. I think Pakistan certainly has influence and could use it to good effect. But I do think that the U.S. has to make sure that other powers that are capable of destabilizing Afghanistan are brought into a process so that the end result is an enduring one.
Let's get some more listeners in here. Here's Doug from Winchester, Virginia. Hi, Doug. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I think the most important point to remember is to take a strategic overview. The details of whether Karzai is corrupt or whether they're going to continue to come up with opium are superfluous. The only thing that counts is a reorientation of the Afghan warlords and the Afghan and Iraqi leaders toward a more acceptable orientation toward us, i.e. that we're the friends, we're the not the enemies. So we don't want them to be a hotbed of dissent and brewing corruption insofar as attacks against us. It is imperative to remember that this is a guerrilla war. We don't have an army fighting an army. The only thing that counts is the disposition of the people, the hearts and minds of the people. The military activities are only a precursor to allow the shifting of opinion and orientation. It is imperative to take the long-term strategic view and not worry about the details of the short-term tactical views.
Doug, thank you. Winning the hearts and minds, General McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal, worked very hard on that front, did he not, Larry?
Well, he did, and General Petraeus, should he be confirmed, which I'm sure he will be, will do the same. Winning hearts and minds, the phrase from an earlier era, is at the core of a counterinsurgency strategy, and General McChrystal's strategy, or at least the version we saw in the Washington Post some months ago, is very population-centric. It's very focused on exactly what Doug had suggested. But as I said before, counterinsurgency on behalf of a fundamentally illegitimate government cannot succeed. When the president talks about that we have to find a political solution and not a military solution, he's exactly right. But what we have done to try to succeed in Afghanistan is deploy more soldiers and Marines and more military forces because, frankly, that's primarily what we have in the foreign policy toolkit.
James Dobbins?
Well, I think Larry may be slightly overstating the degree to which Karzai and his government are considered illegitimate. I think he actually enjoys popularity ratings that our own president would appreciate. But there's no doubt that popular support has declined from unbelievably high levels, but declined. And so has support for the American and NATO presence. But again, it's still very substantial. It's simply declined from extremely high levels. I think the caller was right about the need to focus on the long term, and I think he was also right that in the end, securing the support of the population is essential for stabilizing the country.
Let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts now. Thomas is on the line. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I take an extremely negative view of our whole adventure in Afghanistan, which I equate to Vietnam too. I also remember George Bernard Shaw's famous statement prior to World War II, the only thing we learn from history is we learn nothing from history. And that's what I feel we as Americans have learned in this particular instance.
And so what would you like the U.S. to do at this point, Thomas?
Withdraw.
Get out.
Get out. Get out of town. Yeah. We're supporting a totally corrupt government, and the caller, Doug, talked about winning minds and hearts of the people. We can't do that if the army is, and the police force especially, is corrupt from the top to the bottom.
Thomas, thank you. James Dobbins, let me ask you about Thomas's strategy, just flat leaving, getting out now.
Well, I think that the consequences would be twofold. First of all, Afghanistan would probably descend into a much more serious civil conflict, one comparable to what we saw in the 90s, in which there would be large refugee outflows, much greater numbers of casualties, and as a result, it would again become a very attractive place for extremist elements with global agendas and would again become a hub for essentially violent militants with broader agendas. Now, you can argue those are already in Pakistan, but they're not able to operate with complete freedom in Pakistan. In a chaotic Afghanistan, they probably would be able to operate with considerably greater freedom.
And Larry Goodson, your thoughts?
Well, and in addition to those issues, the greater powers that are engaged in Afghanistan and interested in the regional resources in and around Afghanistan, the $1 trillion that they say worth of minerals and so forth that they found in Afghanistan and the oil and gas in Central Asia and so forth, will be able to sort of pursue all of that without U.S. presence. Plus, there is the ongoing counterterrorism part of the strategy to attack the Taliban and al-Qaeda leadership in and around Afghanistan. So there would certainly be consequences as well as possibly substantial risks, as President Obama has stated in public, to a strategy of just withdrawing. I suspect instead what you're going to see is what we've been told we're going to see, which is a strategy that leaves a certain amount of forces present to engage in training and so forth and counterterrorism operations, and perhaps when the time comes, a withdrawal of some of the other combat forces.
July 2011 withdrawal date currently on the table. Is that enough time to actually make a difference, to actually do something that will be long-lasting?
If you're asking me, the
yes,
answer
Larry.
Is no. You can't mature most of the strategic threads that we're trying to weave together here, state building and counterinsurgency, this sort of hearts and minds approach that the caller had asked about before, in a handful of months, which is why it's meant to be kind of the starting point for a withdrawal and a withdrawal of some of the forces and not all of them. But it's very difficult to achieve what needs to be achieved in Afghanistan to stabilize the place in that short of a time.
Here's to Tarwiz in Portland, Maine. Hello, Tarwiz. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question that they're talking about sharing the power with Taliban. I mean, if they share the power, wouldn't they have the power to open their training camps all over again and do everything because they have power? Aren't we trying to avoid that to begin with?
Tarwiz, thank you. James Dobbins.
Well, the U.S. has laid down three preconditions for any peace settlement. One is that that the insurgents have to cut their ties with al-Qaeda. Second is that they have to accept the Afghan constitution. And the third is that they have to lay down their arms. Now, it's possible, of course, that the outcome of the negotiations might not fully meet all of those conditions. But I do think the U.S. would certainly insist on the first of those, that is, that they cut any ties to al-Qaeda. So the caller's concern is a very real one, and it would be the focus of American efforts in any such negotiations to address satisfactorily.
Here's another listener from Narragansett, Rhode Island. Saber is on the line. Hi, Saber. Welcome to you.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question and also is a comment that to your guest is that everybody is talking about peace, but there will not be a permanent peace in that region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, because under no circumstances Pakistan want a strong Afghan government. That's why they are destabilizing Afghan government and using every means because of the Durand line. So United States and the international community should work between Pakistan and Afghanistan to work out the Durand line, because it's already expired and has no international legitimacy. And that's
so
the Pakistan's threat.
The Durand line by which you speak is the border line that apparently the British drew, which is now expired, I understand. And that's another issue which we don't have time to get to today. But Saber, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Larry Goodson, at the U.S. Army War College, you frequently are called upon to provide input at very senior levels. I'm curious what counsel you're giving these days about the U.S. and its future in Afghanistan.
Well, my biggest concern right now is that we find a way to orient our strategies, the counterterrorism thread, the counterinsurgency thread, the state-building thread, in a way that they can mature and make progress in a short period of time, the time that that is sort of remaining to us that we were talking about a moment ago. I'm also very concerned, to go back to the one caller, Thomas's comment earlier about history, that we look closely at the Soviet experience in the 1980s, because as they were reaching this stage in their involvement in Afghanistan, not to equate them exactly, they embarked on a strategy of population-centric counterinsurgency, on Afghanization of the forces, and on reconciliation. And as we know, that didn't work out very well for the Soviets. So those are the kinds of things I'm worried about right now and talking about right now.
James Dobbins, what are you worried about and talking about right now?
Well, I think the president's announcement that he was going to begin a process of troop drawdown next summer was a bow to his domestic constituencies and dissatisfaction, particularly on his Democratic constituency, rather than a calculated geopolitical move. I think it has unsettled the Afghans. I think it's unsettled the Pakistanis. It's led to an expectation that the U.S. is going to begin a withdrawing, as opposed to simply diminishing slightly its troop presence next year. I think it's going to be a while before the president clarifies his intentions. And I think until he does clarify his intentions, you're going to continue to see this unsettled situation, including within the U.S. administration, over what our long-term commitment and objectives are. The war is ultimately going to end through some kind of negotiated peace. All wars do. And the side that emerges best from that process will be the side that shows the most endurance.
And Larry Goodson, in our last 20 seconds here, your upcoming book is titled Pakistan, Five Things Everyone Should Know. What is the most important thing we should know as we discuss Pakistan today?
Probably the real economic challenges the country faces and the fact that it's the sixth largest country in the world. It's a very serious player.
Well, Larry Goodson joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Thank you very much, Larry.
You're very welcome.
Larry is professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College. And James Dobbins joining me from Washington, D.C. James, thank you.
Pleasure.
James is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get our podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.